Hey, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Brian Beeler. Thanks for tuning in. I've got a couple of great guys from Australia with us today. They're going to talk a little bit about a couple things, including their investment in their latest supercomputer at the Pawsey Supercomputing Center. We've got a scientist guy, we've got a business guy, we've got a lot of great conversation about to happen, but I will warn you, there are two Marks. So we normally only have one guest. We've got two today. They're both Mark. They go by, well, I don't know if I should tell you what they go by, but they, let's call them Science Mark and Business Mark. So let me start with Business Mark, Mark Stickles. Give us just an update on what you guys are doing at the center, what it's about, and just kind of set the tone, especially for our audience that's maybe unfamiliar with your HPC center specifically. What's going on over there?
Great. Well, thanks, Brian, and thanks for the opportunity to support this podcast. We're one of Pawsey Center in Perth, Western Australia. We're one of two national research supercomputing facilities in Australia. So there's one in Canberra on one side of the country and one in Perth on the other side of the country in Western Australia. We provide high-performance compute data services to all of the universities and to CSIRO, our national industrial research organisation in Australia. And we were established as the Pawsey Centre in 2014. But have a long history of working in high-performance computing and visualization in Western Australia before we assumed this status as the Pawsey Centre, with a major investment by the Australian government to build our current systems. Those systems are coming to the end of life, and in 2018, the Australian government invested $70 million Australian dollars, I think about $45 to $50 million US, if a comparison is needed, to upgrade our infrastructure. And this week we've announced the HPE Cray investment. We currently run Cray systems predominantly in our two flagship systems, Magnus and Galaxy, and obviously we're all very excited about this new phase for Pawsey. Pawsey is actually named after an eminent sort of founding scientist in radio astronomy. So one of the things we're known for is the support we provide for the radio astronomy domain. And in Western Australia, we're uniquely positioned as part of the global Square Kilometre Array project, which is that sort of mega science initiative to build vast telescope arrays in the desert of Western Australia and also in South Australia. In South Africa, so a little bit further afield. But this global project is building large telescope arrays that will enable science in radio astronomy to advance even further. So Joseph Pawsey was an early pioneer in that science in Australia, and we're named after that scientist, and we provide direct compute and data processing support for the telescopes that are about 800 kilometres north of Pawsey. So we actually have a connection to them. And to give you some sense of scale, Western Australia is about one third of the size of Australia, and roughly we're about the same sort of size as the North American sort of continent. But Western Australia has about one tenth of the population of Texas, right. And we're about three times the size of Texas. So to give you an idea of scale and geography, we're a large state with a smaller population. But in the area of HPC and data science, we're doing some cool things.
Well, Perth houses the Australian Mint, doesn't it? If I'm not incorrect, there.
It does, and yes, we're a major exporter of iron ore and LNG, liquid natural gas, gold, right. Many minerals sustain not just the West Australian economy, but the Australian economy is supported by the resources sector.
All right, so you talked a little bit about the science there. So let's bring in the science Mark Gray, who has spent time at NASA, amongst other places that, you know, maybe we've heard of. The telescope angle is really interesting. The way you're exploring science using HPC, I think, is super interesting. Mark Gray, what's kind of the latest on the scientific effort in your center, and just what's going on there that's compelling, that's leveraging these kinds of technical resources?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Well, we're kind of at a interesting point, both in terms of the science and the infrastructure. PAWSI, in some ways, is a non-traditional high-performance computing center operating a supercomputer, where we're also supporting this big science instrument that's being built out in the desert about 800 kilometers from here. And it puts kind of operational and kind of immediate requirements on the facility that kind of go beyond a little bit what a traditional supercomputer center does, which is, you know, typically high volume physical and chemical modeling and running, you know, big CFD models and this kind of thing. And so we do that because that's the core part of really kind of high, large size science. But then in addition, we have this data stream that we have to maintain. It requires access to, you know, high volume, high speed storage systems. Those ideally should be well integrated with storage infrastructure, with a compute infrastructure. And so so we're kind of trying to do everything all at the same time. It's a bit like trying to spin a bunch of plates all at the same time, I guess. And then at the same time, there's so much other stuff happening in science and the way science is really making use of compute. You know, traditionally, supercomputing centers like ours are actually created by and for computation chemists and computational physicists. And they've been really the bread and butter of facilities like ours everywhere in the world. And then right now, there's this emerging group of people coming out of fields like medical informatics and bioinformatics, which are putting different kinds of demands on the infrastructure. And they come with a very different kind of computational background, which and the challenge really is on us to build a single facility that meets all of these, you know, somewhat competitive kind of demands and requirements.
Well, let me ask you about how HPC in your part of the world is maybe similar or different than in the U.S. or anywhere else. I've been to Supercompute a number of times in the U.S. It bounces around the cities. I'm sure there's equivalents in other parts of the world to talk about these HPC concerns. And, well, one, there's no other place on the planet where I've been where I've felt so dumb because I walk into these places and into the conference center, and especially when you get in the back corners where the universities are that are talking about their research projects, or you've got NOAA there or NASA or anyone that's doing all this data visualization and analytics. And it's so cool, but it's also frankly, it's intimidating. And I do wonder about that, you know, for other reasons that we can get into, but It feels like the HPC world that we have in North America is maybe a little more fragmented than yours, because I see a lot of universities. I see a lot of, we do have some large HPC centers, but it feels just like sometimes it's more project-based, which is inefficient because you've got people getting grant money and building up infrastructures and then tearing them down, and maybe that equipment doesn't get repurposed or something. Is there a big difference between the way HPC works in different parts of the world?
Oh yeah, I really think there is. You're right about your description of the US as this kind of fragmented environment. Literally. Yeah, somewhat fragmented in the sense that there's lots of different facilities and they all run facilities at different scale. Australia is so small, you know. I mean, we are, physically large, but, you know, we're at a kind of a science size, you know, we're the size of a mid-sized US state. And so, So we are much less fragmented because, you know, there's much less investment, and where the investment does exist, it is really focused, you know, on the the core science infrastructure. In our case, us and the National Computational Infrastructure in Canberra, the two main Tier 1 HPC sites in Australia, that is the majority of the investment in an HPC in Australia. There are other small clusters at some of the universities, but they're not the same scale as the Tier 1 facilities. Whereas, you know, in the United States, there are university clusters that are probably bigger than some of our national clusters. There are individual university systems, you know, that are bigger than the entire Australian university sector. So then you've of course got the really big systems, you know, what are coming, the DOE labs in the United States that are, you know, building the really enormous new systems that are coming in the next couple of years. Europe, my impression is that they're kind of in between. They collaborate more in the generation of the kind of pan-European kind of infrastructure. The example right now is the Xscale compute project in Europe, where they're building three prototype kind of pre-Xscale facilities. Most recently, one which announced a couple of days ago, Lumi in Finland. And that's really the focus of investment. And there are individual national and university infrastructures that are also quite large. But I think my impression is that the Xscale facilities are, again, the focus of that investment in the European sense. We are, on the other hand, quite uniform, but only because there's so few facilities, really.
Can I add a ride?
Business Mark just was flexing on how big Australia is, and then the Science Mark laid it straight. But all right, what's the deal?
Well, Mark, I'm not going to disagree with my colleague because we don't have the zeros on the the decimal point needs to be another point across in order for us to invest at the same scale at some of the national labs and the European consortia. So Mark's quite right there. But I will make a shout out for the Australian sort of attitude in terms of collaboration and sort of reaching out. I think we can network and partner effectively because we've done so through necessity and opportunity. I think there's something in the way we go about things here in Australia that is quite positive, and so we've reached out and have good relationships with consortia centres in Europe and also in some of the national labs in the US, and we can perhaps do things to connect across some of the large centres of gravity that exist in the US, for example. We've had engagements with individual institutes that perhaps wouldn't necessarily happen between those institutes in the US because of their scale and focus. So there is, I'm not disagreeing with Mark, but there is something that we can offer, I think, in that way.
Yeah, and another part of that is I think we punch above our weight when it comes to, you know, what we get done with the resources that we have. And that's both the human resources and the capital resources that we put together. You know, when we're building a new supercomputer, like and what we're about to do over the next 18 months, we can't rely on, well, if we don't get this right, there'll be another supercomputer in 4 years that'll pick up the slack. This our system has to be successful. It has to be well used. It's critical to Australian research that it be used. There isn't a secondary facility that people can go to. There's just the two tier one facilities. And if we collectively drop the ball, then the whole Australian research environment suffers. On the converse part of that, I think we're very adaptable and we're very pragmatic in the way that we get things done. And for us, the product, the actual delivery of the facility is the guiding principle. We have to get research achieving science, and we'll do whatever we can to actually make that happen.
Well, talk for a minute about how the HPC model works for you, because, you know, I think we spend a lot of time talking to enterprises, mid-market businesses, that sort of thing, about infrastructure, and they're thinking about, okay, server switches, storage, or maybe it's HCI, or maybe it's cloud, or maybe it's, you know, those things as a service in the cloud, whatever nonsense it is, it doesn't really matter. But all the big IT vendors are trying to solve these problems for mainstream businesses. And in those structures, you've got infrastructure and IT, and their constituents are typically application owners, whether it's a web app or, you know, it, or CRM, it doesn't really matter. There's a whole level of applications that they've got to support in those app owners. In your world, you're building the infrastructure and you're provisioning time against that to your constituents, which are scientists largely, it may, maybe not exclusively, but, you know, maybe you can clarify that. But how do you view your relationship with your investments in infrastructure and how that serves your constituents versus how it works in a more traditional enterprise way? I've already heard you talk about planning is a big deal because you've got to look at these massive investments for some period of time, where in the enterprise, if you need more storage or more compute, it's relatively easy to, you know, budgets aside, to go slam in another, you know, 12 or 14 or a rack of servers. You know, it's not that big of a deal. But talk about that a little bit, just to help characterize the difference between the HPC world and the traditional enterprise world.
So by all means, Mark, big Mark, if you want to step in. But so we're fundamentally different, really, to enterprise compute. And you mentioned, you know, in the enterprise world, yeah, if you need another 12 racks, well, you know, you're making money, so go buy them, right? And presumably, if your, you know, your job is to make money, and you're making money, and you then reinvest that money in your infrastructure, you're making more money. It's a beautiful, beautiful story, which falls apart completely when you try and look at that in a kind of research HPC context, because if we outstrip demand, we won't get more money. And not only that, but the way we it's getting a little bit into the weeds, but capital investment and operational investment are totally independent in centers like us. And other centers like this have the same issue. And so you know, it challenges us when it comes to trying to scale certain kinds of infrastructure up, because lots of infrastructures have both capital expense, but then operational expense models that are tied to the size of that infrastructure. So the classic one is storage, right? You know, lots of storage systems have licensing costs that are, you know, closely related to the size of the storage infrastructure or the throughput of the storage infrastructure. And for us, that's a really hard to match challenge because, you know, because our operational and our capital investment is quite independent. If the federal government says, "Hey, go buy a new supercomputer," and it's going to be, you know, 50 times larger than your current one, we don't get 50 times more staff, and we don't get 50 times more money, power, and any of those other things. And so, but we still have to make use of it, and the investment's there to be used, and we're going to make sure that's the case. But it's that's the big difference, I think, between us and enterprise compute is the way, well, the kind of, it's the way we pay for it, basically. And would you kind of agree to all that, Mark? Am I getting in trouble?
I'll leave Brian to do judicious editing if it's needed. But it is an interesting environment. We are funded by a range of different sources. So our partners, so our universities and the National Science Organisation, the West Australian Government and the Australian Government, and they all make different types of investments with different expectations of returns. What is challenging is the if you like, the political timetable, the political cycle is different to that of our own sort of planning cycle. So we can transcend those sorts of cycles in terms of the planning and the standing up of new infrastructure and services. So there's a job to be done to demonstrate sort of value over time and a return to those investors. The environment in which the projects are supported, even though we talk about ourselves as a public research facility, it's an incredibly competitive environment for researchers to secure the funding to run their projects and to operate. So there's a level of competition and variation in the different areas that get supported. So I imagine that some of the large national lab facilities have a certain critical mass around a certain discipline and a certain national need. Our research, I haven't thought of it in this way before, it's perhaps we're a little bit more, if you like, free market. There's certain push and pull of different initiatives that have to compete for limited research funding, both capital and operating, and that creates a certain both attention but also a need to sort of collaborate and cooperate within institutions to take advantage of a finite amount of public sector funding. There is a degree of industry funding for this sort of work, but there's also other channels for that industry to get their research done. So that's a sort of third stream as well.
Well, you've got a number of projects going on. How do you allocate resources? So how do you think about if I come to you as a scientist and say, I want to study, you know, whatever, whether it's the telescope or, you know, honestly, between us, I'm a avid connoisseur of bold red wines, and I know there are many in Australia. I believe it's Barossa. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. The valley there that makes some fabulous cabs and red blends. Anyway, whether or not you're studying wine or space or nature, how do you deal with understanding those needs budgetarily, you know, financially, but also your finite time of cycles available on your systems?
You could argue that it takes a supercomputer to do our budgeting and allocation. there's another colleague, Dr. Marcia Zatelski, who has a facing role with respect to our users and the allocation models for our systems. And so I'm lighthearted in saying it's complex, but we do allocate resources to a national merit-based pool. So the quality is determined by an academic peer review process, and we do that on an annual cycle. We do also allocate resources to our core partners who help pay for some of the overhead costs of running the centre.
Makes sense.
And we have some priority areas. So we support the domain of radio astronomy with some dedicated allocations and have a modest allocation that's considered director's share, which is essentially that 5% of our resources that can go into innovative early stage projects that are trying to scale up to HPC or strategic projects of note. So there's at a high level, an annual cycle, but there's many categories within, but the majority, 95% of the resources are based on merit and the quality of the science and assessed by peers and experts in the various domains as a general principle for our resources.
Well, how far out does that scheduling go? Because with this kind of investment in an HPC center, I assume your goal is to have 100% utilization, right? Else then you have resources wasted. But 100% is probably a tad aggressive because, you know, you just can't. So how do you map that out to try to line up what those workloads need versus what you have? I mean, it seems, oh gosh, in a private enterprise, you know, you can say the SQL server runs our transaction for our web store or whatever, so it's mission critical. It gets tier zero, and you can define those workloads, and it will be at that level forever and ever because it's our thing. In your world, you've got so many different constituents. I just wonder, not only, I mean, you talked a little bit about how you balance who gets access, but when is also fundamentally important, I would think.
Yeah, so obviously, this gets very complicated. The core answer, though, is that researchers themselves have to, when they're applying for time, have to explain how they're going to use it. And they have to show that they have the necessary experience to be able to make use of that compute time. It's a precious commodity, which is expensive to operate. And, you know, if someone gets a big project, someone gets a 50 million core hour account and then doesn't use it, then there's other laudable projects that have been declined time, and many projects have declined time in our system that could have run, right? And so that's taken very, very, very seriously, both by the committees that manage the allocations and by us. So we monitor, use very frequently for the facility. We actually also observe, at some level, what researchers are actually doing on the facility while they're running, to make sure that they're actually making good use of their time. And when we have concerns, we directly contact those researchers and we say, hey, this is not an efficient use of the compute. We really need to rethink about this workflow. And then we have, science specialists who can work with researchers to make sure their workflows are in fact fit for purpose for the facility. But then the application side, the answer is many more people apply than get time. There's a very strong merit kind of process where you have to establish, that you know what you're doing and your work is in fact valuable. And so the national infrastructure should spend time making your work go.
We were almost two times oversubscribed last year. And so there's a clear demand for an uplift in the national capacity. But the merit-based world that we live in and the fundamental science that we support, I think illustrates why it's important that the state, the government, invests in this sort of facility, because it doesn't fit neatly into a commercial model. I think some aspects of our researchers, our universities, will use the commercial providers for certain things, but there's this core that we do around fundamental research and some of the sort of frontier research that needs this level of nationally funded and state funded support, because the business model is not perfectly tuned to that of a commercial provider.
No, you're exactly right. And I think that's what I was hinting at, if not explicitly, that in all of my times of going to the supercompute show, I've seen a migration, at least again in the US and my more US centric view, of researchers filling out a pitch and a plan to secure funding for whatever it is, and to support that research we need a million or two, whatever numbers of dollars, to build an infrastructure to do that analysis. And in the early days they were getting funding for that, and at the end of the project or the research, that infrastructure was never accounted for, and it just sort of went away. It was given away or recycled or stolen by the students at the school, well, whatever, right? And it always struck me as ridiculous that we would give as a nation or as a state or as a stakeholder in cancer research or whatever, that we would allocate funds in that way. It makes no sense. Wouldn't it be better if we coalesce those funds into a professional organization that managed these things? And it sounds like that's what you're doing at the country level and then state level in Australia. And I think we're getting closer to that, because as I watch the progression of what the big universities are doing now, at least they're training their professors to don't go buy a bunch of servers and storage and switch, because you don't even know how to use that stuff anyway. Put the budget into our HPC effort, and then we'll rent you back the time. And you can do that way more cost effectively than buying all the pieces. And the scientists, the guys that are like you're dealing with that are running these telescopes, aren't storage networking compute admins. Like, this is not where they should be spending their time. They should be solving life's big mysteries, right?
Yeah, and there's another area where that's, at the beginning when we were in the preamble, I mentioned areas like bioinformatics and medical informatics as the kind of areas where there's kind of growth. So another example of that is medical instrumentation, right? I mean, modern medical instrumentation is getting very, very high resolution. And so, you know, gene sequences, for instance, you know, producing huge amounts of data. So there comes a point where if you're running an instrument, you know, in a current or immediately previous generation of infrastructure, you might put a, you know, big expensive workstation next to that instrument to actually run that. Now, now that thing might produce itself, you know, half a petabyte of data a year. And you can, there's no workstation that can handle that. Now you need a rack. And so you've either got a rack of compute and storage next to every instrument, or you've got, you rip out, you know, half a floor of your hospital and you put in a server room, right? Or you leverage a more focused infrastructure that, again, in some places can do that, you know, with their kind of enterprise kind of compute. But then at a research level, you know, there's economies of scale that you get when you consolidate all this equipment and this investment in a single place. And then the other part is the usability of it, right? I mean, the bigger your storage infrastructure, the more admins you need. Now everyone's got to have those as well. There's a lot of work involved. And then on the compute side, I mean, lots of projects, they don't have just a nice, steady, you know, the identical amount of compute they want to do every day. It's quite spiky, and some weeks they do a lot, and the following week they don't do so much. If you're running your own infrastructure, then during those low periods, the whole thing's just going to waste. If you've kind of corporatized that infrastructure, then you can make sure that with a whole bunch of different projects, and that it's actually going to good use all the time.
Add another point to that. Sorry, Brian, I feel like I'm going
to... No, please.
Just another perspective to add to Mark's point. There's an efficiency point about what Mark has expressed, I think. But I think there's also an opportunity for our scientists who are historically science, you know, based on hypothesis and experimentation, generating data, and then analyzing that data and then re-experimenting and so on. The proliferation of data and the way that instrumentation in science now is generating data, there's actually a changing nature of science. And I think some facilities like PAWSI and NCI and others around the world have their own contribution to make in working with scientists. So it's not just a service and efficiency opportunity. It's also with new AI and ML technologies and being able to link and manage data sets, you can actually not just have science generating data, but your data can actually generate new science. And that's where centres like PAWSI and others around the world can relate to scientists in a different way and I think add something to new science.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. So one of the other things I was thinking about while you were talking about these scientific projects that come in, use your resources and run their analysis. What does that data flow look like? Because we think a lot about these infrastructures, but there's always the data in, data out migration issue because your workloads are so transient. What happens if I'm a scientist, I go to your center, I qualify for some time, I import a bunch of data, that takes time, I run my analytics, and that creates a bunch more data, and now I've got to go take that somewhere? How does that workflow work for scientists that when they leave or when they're done, if they're ever done, I don't know if they're like Hotel California with you or what, but if they ever leave, how do they manage that massive data set?
How long is a piece of string? there's so many answers to that question. I'm kind of trying to decide where I should go with that. Because, you know, if all of our work was purely transient, then in many ways our life would be relatively easy. In the sense that, you know, we have big, very high performance scratch file systems that complement our HPC facilities. And they're built around, they have very aggressive purge policies. You can't store data there for very long. Occasionally, researchers have extremely unfortunate kind of learning processes where they find that we really do very stress out with them on a regular basis. And if you put your thesis there, that's really bad for you, right? I mean, awkward.
And, sure.
Right. But typically, because it's different fields. Some fields start with I'm generalizing a lot, right? But they start with an observation. They generate enormous amounts of maths, and the output is a number. And so you don't need to store that. That's a thing. It's 3.6. We're done. Fantastic.
Sure.
Prize. But then there's other science, like in bioinformatics and also radio astronomy, right, where the output data is as big, sometimes bigger than the input data. And you're pulling in petabytes of data, and then you're putting out petabytes of data, and yeah, you've got to put that somewhere. The way we manage that is we have fairly substantial slower storage systems where people can kind of plant their research data for a period, but they eventually have to get it off there. We don't provide, basically long-term, like decadal archive storage facilities, because we're just not funded to do that. In the Australian research environment, frequently that responsibility falls to the universities. So the researchers have to arrange to get their data off the system and onto the university storage system, so they can put their data away, so it can be archived for 20 years to support their research paper or whatever. And then our role is supporting that, so making sure that the researcher understands that they need to move their data, that there's a time frame in which that has to be done, and then supporting the systems to make it possible. Because of all the things that that challenge us, one of the big challenges still remains moving data around the place.
Right. I mean, that hasn't changed at all. It's gotten a little bit faster if you've got a good connection speed, but still, even today, we talk about SneakerNet being faster for in the field, people shooting a commercial or a movie or whatever. It still creates that massive file that is faster to FedEx than it is to transfer over the wire in many cases.
Yeah, so what our equivalent saying here is that you can't underestimate the bandwidth of a ute filled with hard drives.
Right. I think we've got a Subaru is often what's used here, but whatever the case is.
Is that an Australian invention, just to sort of plug our innovation credentials? Sized it in the States, I think, but we might claim it. But anyway, that could be contentious.
Well, I tell you what, we've got a bunch of trucks here. I don't know if you want to put a bunch of hard drives in an F-150 because it'll probably bounce out. But we've got the new Bronco coming back. We've got all these off-roaders.
Most of them going around. You can't guarantee 100% data throughput, but 95% they make it pretty fast. So,
it's a different set of problems for sure.
From our point of view as a facility, though, we perhaps have an established business model for compute, making it publicly merit based and accessible, and so on. But the volumes of data and the expectations of data management and data processing, the business model for that, for our facility, is needing to evolve. And that's something that we are actively working on. The technology behind it is something that Mark's leading to integrate and to make that, take full advantage of our new architecture. But how we work with our researchers to say, perhaps we can't store petabytes in the way you'd like it, you've got to manage your own archiving and retrieval or resurvey the sky, because the telescopes can do that, and we can acquire the data more efficiently than we can store it and process it some point down the track. That involves a discussion with our key research groups and emerging research groups in the bio space. We can work with them to optimize their processes, because it is a challenging area around data storage and archiving and migration and so on. The compute is getting faster and more efficient, but the business model for us around data is evolving or needing to evolve.
Well, for the, I don't really want to say cold data because it doesn't sound like it's cold, but it's low activity data once it's captured and analyzed. That seems like one of the places where cloud object storage is pretty good, but at the scale you're talking about, it's still relatively expensive to move it about. Is there a good cloud play here for your scientists, or is that too confusing or complex or expensive?
Yeah, I mean, that's so the answer is yes. And our answer to that is to actually embrace those technologies internally. So, running cloud infrastructures, adopting cloud technology, cloud-like technologies in our core infrastructure is, I think, the direction that we're heading there. And so that's, for us, what that looks like is, large-scale object storage a way of managing the infrastructure, the very, very large, and I'm thinking, 50, 100 petabyte, POSIX file systems really aren't an attractive thing for us, and they seem very hard to manage. And even if you want to go down that path, whereas object storage for this, so this exact kind of use case where you're parking semi-cold data, then and then cold is a relative concept here. The object storage is seems like the way to go. The costs aren't too bad, actually, depending on how you do it. The biggest difference is between say. Some other storage media is your options. You're really varying the capital expense versus the operational expense, and they're all quite different. And there's just a question, or the core question for us is, what can afford, and what's the best thing we can do with the limited funds that we have. That's the process. And what's going to be best for researchers, because. We could build a giant, very cold data storage, but then if there isn't enough throughput capability to get data in and out of that, then it's not actually much use to anybody, because a lot of our researchers' data, they're just not that cold. They still want to be able to read it, in a reasonable amount of time. And some of those data sets are large. So someone puts a bunch of data somewhere, say, the radio astronomers want to do a whole sky survey, and they need to stage 4 petabytes of data to do some analytics. That's a bit of a job, to be honest. And you need to, if that's kind of your use pattern, then you really need to think carefully about what you're buying to make sure that it's going to be able to support that, and not have a situation where the researcher says, yes, I want to stage my 4 petabytes of data, and 9 months later, it's available. that's not going to work. And then, not only that, but they want to stage their 4 petabytes of data, they want to do their science with it, and then they're done. They just want to get rid of it, right? And then there's some product they need to store as well, and so it all kind of grows. It's a really tricky one. I actually find compute's complicated, but relatively easy compared to, the storage question and how we thread our way through all this.
So it's funny because you think about the data in like a media and entertainment world, it's red cameras, 4K, 8K, they can understand 30 minutes of streaming a scene for a movie is going to be this heavy, and this is how we got to move it and plan all that. And they're thinking always in terms of data, because until that data from the camera is offloaded and it's put in two places and one's in a box and shipped away, they won't shut down the set, because you're waiting to make sure that that data is validated, that it's secure, and that you have the shot that you think you have. And keeping actors and food services and like all those people around is expensive. And so they try to do that as quickly as possible. In the science world, I wonder, maybe you've got some insight. So if we're firing up these telescopes and mapping the heavens, it seems to me that the scientists are thinking more about their area of study, and rightly they should, that's their expertise, than the infrastructure impact on guys like you that have got to figure out, okay, well, all of a sudden we have all these terabytes and eventually petabytes and one day exabytes of data sitting around that is not inexpensive to just hold. Like that's a big challenge. So how do you communicate that with your constituents in terms of resource? I asked early on about resource allocation. I was thinking more compute, but the more we talk about this, I'm thinking, gosh, do they even understand the impact of storage potentially on what they're doing?
So the answer to the question, how do we do that? Carefully. and with sensitivity, because yeah, you're right. Scientists who are, you know, domain experts in the field frequently don't have a deep understanding of all this. And to be honest, I don't think they should. They should be focusing on their science.
Absolutely, sure.
That's why we exist, to advise them and say, well, okay, here are the options. Here's the ways we can do this. You know, these are the things we can achieve with the infrastructure that we've got. And here are some of the pragmatic, you know, things you're going to need to worry about, right? As we're going through that process. And then the other part of it is, you know, not all science is the same. So, you know, an example of some science where, yeah, you turn the thing on and you must collect the data, the LHC in Europe, you know, when they spin up the particle accelerator, it's very expensive to turn on. It's you want to collect all that data. The new high luminosity experiment that they're about to start is they're going to produce data at ridiculous volumes and ridiculous speeds, and all must be collected because you don't have to repeat the experiment as well.
Right.
Whereas if you're looking at say the deep universe, right, it doesn't change from day to day. So, or in fact, millennia to millennia, there are things in it that do change, and you want to be able to spot those ephemeral events. But if you're, you know, trying to do an analysis on, you know, the very finely detailed map of the background radiation of the universe, well, that doesn't change. So, you know, hypothetically, if you had a very fast throughput pipe to your instrument, you know, it might actually be quicker to redo the observation than it is to recover the data from a slow storage facility, especially if it's a lot of data.
Right.
So you really need to think, and how you solve, you know, the way you solve those problems, or have different economies in terms of how you would solve that. Right. So if you're really worried about throughput and you didn't have to worry so much about storage, then you can invest in that direction and get super fat pipes and really optimize that infrastructure to make sure that data gets through when you need it. And you can get it again if you want it. But if your instrument or your observation is, say, if it's gene, you know, three-dimensional scanning and genomic analysis of someone's tumor, right? You don't want to have to repeat the experiment. Some of them are invasive and painful. And there's an immediacy to the results. You need to be able to get them somewhere and then recover them as you need, you know, in a timely way. So, you know, that's just two examples plucked out of the air, right? But there's lots of other examples that are kind of almost like a spectrum, you know, of science.
But in both of those examples, though, Mark, we have research fellows and application specialists in CORSI that have some domain knowledge and that are working with research groups that, in the case of radio astronomy, they see us as part of the telescope. So increasingly we're on the right side of the conversation with those groups to bring insights into these challenges around data management and data storage and so on. And in the case of the medical applications, which are more emergent, help them design and operate in a more productive way from a compute and data point of view from the outset. And so both examples, I think we're trying to work with those research communities to deliver the best sort of value we can.
Yeah, that's actually why the all this infrastructure is, you know, the blinky lights part that I'm technically in charge of. it's the human part of our organization that is in some ways the most valuable, because, you know, it's our specialist staff talking to researchers who understand the nature of their problem, and to help them understand how the technology can be used to solve their problems. that is the key. You know, one of our when we're talking to researchers, researchers frequently tell us what they want. And that's useful information, but it doesn't tell us what we need to do, because what we actually need to do is solve the problem of what they need. And sometimes what they want and what they need might be different. And then we have a limited, you know, budget, and so we want to focus on the needs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I walk outside and see the moon and the stars and take a photo and just want to put a Instagram filter on it and, you know, post it to the world. I don't know if you're, are you helping with that, or is that too much for your HPC constraints?
Pretty pictures are actually really important inside, which is, and I'm saying that, you know, a little bit pejoratively, but actually, you know, being able to articulate science in a visual way is actually really important. We have a whole team here set aside to help researchers with exactly that problem, which is, okay, you've got a grabby data set, but let's turn it into a visualization. Part of our hardware refresh over the next 18 months is to redo our on-premises visualization facilities, because there's a beautiful picture of the moon, you know, is very tangible thing that everyone can understand. If you can turn your science into a cool picture, then it kind of cuts through, you know, a lot of argument. And looks great on the cover of a, you know, magazine as well.
There's no doubt in my mind. And in fact, I've seen so many data visualizations over the years where you're like, there are 100 ways to do it. It's a data tube, it's streams, it's shadings, and it takes data that is highly complicated and took perhaps years or, you know, thousands of devices or whatever to figure out, and distills it into a visual image that just resonates with certain people's brains faster than, and frankly, most of us aren't going to read the 100-page or 500-page report behind it. But if we get that one picture to say, okay, I see how we can get from A to B, and that makes sense, and that's great. And by the way, we're not training our children and our next generations to be any smarter using, you know, Snapchat and Instagram to consume everything quickly, to make a decision quickly. Everything's quick, and these quick hits. So a visualization, and you could say a board of investors or government employees that help determine your fate are equally as intelligent as teenagers using Instagram, if you like, or maybe I'll just make that assertion. But a visual helps, right? That's very simple. So we've talked all this time, and I don't think I've even given you a moment to talk about much about this next generation center that you guys are so excited about and how we got connected in the first place. We've followed Cray for, gosh, you know, in my work personally for almost a decade. HPE picked them up along the way, and now they're integrating AMD CPUs into their infrastructure. When you look at your universe, which is so hyper-specific in terms of the equipment that you put to work on the floor and the budgets that you have and the planning that you have, you're looking long-term, well, longer term than the typical enterprise looks at infrastructure investments. You've made this call to go to the next gen Cray infrastructure on AMD. How did that work? How did that happen? And why was that the right call for you guys?
We have made that call. There's multiple reasons for that. I mean, when we went through our tender, you know, we received a number of, you know, very high quality proposals for the next generation of our supercomputer. The attraction of the HPE Cray offer I think a lot of it really was the quality of the software environment. actually, and the quality of the interconnect, the stitched it all together, and then another factor was really things like the size of the facility and the efficiency of the facility, the energy efficiency, but where they really I think distinguished themselves was really in those first things, that the quality of that environment and the novelty of that environment. One of the I think there was a line in our tender which said something like, we want a HPC facility that can be operated like a cloud or something like that. I can't remember the exact word we used, but we clearly implied that we wanted to see cloud-like technologies being used to good effect in this facility, and all of the applicants or the proposals understood that to include things like Kubernetes and containers, and that should all show up there. The infrastructure that we're getting has a really, really good answer to all of those kind of questions. What is the integration of cloud-like technologies in HPC facility? Where are the integration opportunities between, say, our traditional kind of on-premises cloud infrastructure, the storage infrastructure, and the HPC? How's that going to work? I kind of feel like we've got answers to all those in this particular thing that we're building. And then, energy efficiency is pretty high on my mind. Being the kilowatt cost per petaflop, that you have to, the power you spend to turn these things on is a big deal. It's a huge part of our expense, but it's also a huge concern of our researchers. I've been to so many meetings in the last year where researchers have said, what are you doing about power efficiency? How are you going to, lower the carbon footprint of this facility? And in this facility, we have an answer to that question. We have tenfold improvement in power efficiency or energy efficiency in the facility. And that's really, really important because it also kind of answers a little bit of the question of how we can potentially scale it up.
It's important to note that it was a public tender. We run as a national sort of Commonwealth funded facility, so there was a high degree of probity and sort of process around the assessment of the compliant tenders. But Mark's right that the sort of key criterion around performance and the integration, the sort of hardware software integration that was offered, the energy efficiency, and also the price. I think we have to evaluate the sort of commercial, make a commercial decision at the end. So, but energy was very important and addressed well in this solution. And as Mark said, the cost and interest in that area around efficiency is something that was part of the first generation or the current generation of Pawsey architecture. We have a geothermal cooling and solar system that supports cooling aspect of our infrastructure, and we want to bring the 10 times improvement in energy efficiency to bear in our next generation. So that's particularly important to us.
Yeah, that's amazing. When do you gentlemen expect to have this new infrastructure online? I understand it's not just a drop in and replace, so you guys plan much longer term than traditional enterprise investment. So what does that look like in terms of your calendar?
No pressure here, Mark, but this is going to go on the record.
Blinky lights, Mark. What's the plan?
So early 2022 is, I think, when we're going to have the facility up and running in its kind of full sense. So it's actually multi-stage deployment because we've got an existing, before we started the actual podcast here, we were talking a little bit about, the necessity I have to kind of migrate users from our existing system to the new one. So we actually have to continue to operate our existing facility for some period while we get ready for the new one. And what our deployment looks like is a stage one deployment, which is about 5% of the total compute, which is going to show up in the early part of next year. That is going to allow us to, although there's only 5% of the total compute, it's 2.5 times more compute than we currently have. And that's going to allow us to migrate users in an orderly way onto this system, which is actually going to be quite similar to the existing one. You know, CPU technology, and we have a Cray at the moment, so some of those migrations are going to be, I think, relatively easy. And then we can decommission that existing equipment and then get ready for the 95% of the rest of the compute, which is going to show up, you know, at some point in late 2021 and then be available for users in the early 2022 period. So, and you'll notice that I'm not saying things like months or even quarters in that statement, because there are so many variables.
Yeah,
I'm picking up. That's right. Oh, sorry, the bad connection. Yes, but as we really get into the early stages of the deployment, now obviously we've got a timetable right now that we're all trying to meet, us and the vendor, HPE Cray, but you know, we're also dealing with a few unknowns in our scheduling, especially around delivery equipment and availability of people because of the COVID-19 situation that we have. And so we're taking that into account. You know, it's an unwelcome but, you know, necessary thing for us to be aware of. And it certainly is, you know, it can have impacts on some of our supply chain activities.
Mark, I mean, I might have put you on the spot there, but there's a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of goodwill that's been built up. I mean, we're going through extraordinary times with COVID this year, and we've been on remote work footing since early March here in WA. But the enthusiasm in the team, the sort of technical people that will help stand this facility up, the ongoing support we have from a great project team around our capital refresh is holding us in good stead, and we're building a partnership with HPE Cray that's built on a long-standing relationship we have as well. So there will be some challenges, and the supply chain one is of note, Mark mentioned, but this is my job to be half glass full in these things. So and we have good relationships with the other large sites that are installing the similar architecture. So we'll be part of a community of sites that are going down this this path, and hopefully we'll benefit from that relationship.
All right, let me ask you one last thing. I know we're past our time, but this is an interesting thing. So the top 500, how important to you guys, and it could be zero, that's fine, is it from a credibility or machismo kind of standard, is it to be considered in that realm of supercomputer sites, and is that important to you guys at all in your consideration?
It's I'm relatively new to the space, so I've been in this space for 2 years now at Pawsey, and so I understand and respect the need to sort of measure and benchmark and so on, but we're never going to compete with the level of investment that is in the national labs and the consortia in Europe and throughout the world. So it'll be fantastic. We will be in the top tier for a period of time, and I think we'll remain in that top tier. But I'm more interested, I think the team at Pawsey are more interested in talking about what we do and the novel science and the application and innovation that we can enable, rather than always counting on a particular number in the rank and the rankings. We do want to stand up our system and have it measured in its green performance, in its I/O performance, and in its initial standing. But that's respectfully, that's not our driver. I hope you heard from talking to Mark and I, the science that we support and the researchers that we engage with and the challenges. I mean, we stood up a COVID support through our new Nimbus cloud earlier in this year to do some COVID-related research. We are working with radio astronomers in really, really cool, large-scale, ambitious science. That's what motivates us, and if we can we can be part of their success, that will be what truly counts.
Good for you. I mean, that's fantastic. Do you have a name? Because all the cool clusters have a name. What's the name for this new one?
Look, we haven't released the name. What we will be doing.
Oh, come on! It must be something dramatic, like Rugby Killer or something, or it must be something.
I'm not. You could twist my arm as much as you like. It's not coming out today. It will come out in the new year because we also have some. I will share. We'll have some fantastic artwork to go on, and part of what we've done with the current systems is to have a respectful relationship with the Indigenous landholders and the Indigenous peoples of the country in which the telescopes are maintained, and also with our traditional owners of the land in which we operate. So there is a process underway that will reflect that in the naming of the system in early 2021. But we'll be sure to give you a call, Brian, and have a conversation about that because it will be cool. I know it's going to be cool, and we'll have some things to show on the floor in 2021. But at the moment, the name is a secret.
All right. You're not going to show me because I will come and I will be there. I want to see this thing happening. I want to see these telescopes. I want to see I've got a big adventure. I want to see the Wine Valley. I want to see the telescope. Well, we'll get to the supercomputer.
Barossa is in South Australia, and that is
I don't care. I'll see it all. I'll be everywhere.
Margaret River in Western Australia is also world class. And
perfect.
We would love to have you sample some of our local product in the region.
That deal is done. I will be out there and looking forward to it. And gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Great conversation. Love your energy. Love everything about what you guys are doing. And I think this visibility into what HPC can be, you guys are a great model to be looked at around the world, honestly, for what science can be and why this is so important, not just in your area, but in every area. So thank you, gentlemen, both the Marks, for being part of this today.
Thanks a lot.
Brian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.